I'm Lee Hay, and this is a look at Cincinnati filmmaker Steve Gebhardt, who is well known for his documentation of world-famous musicians. He founded the UC Film Society in 1961 and later taught film courses at the University of Cincinnati and Antioch College. After moving to New York City, Mr. Gebhardt filmed John and Yoko Ono, Carla Bley, and the Rolling Stones. His work continued with musicians, including the film Bill Monroe, Father of Bluegrass Music, in the 1990s. In the next hour, you'll hear a conversation between David Delegater and Steve Gebhardt about his films with Carla Bley and John Sinclair. This is Steve Gebhardt, Cincinnati filmmaker.
Do it if you haven't done it. You'll do it anyway. It's all up to you. And you might as well face it. It's not up to you anyway.
I'm David Delegater. Joining us today is Steve Gebhardt, Cincinnati filmmaker, and he's here to talk about his documentary movie, Escalator Over the Hill, music by Carla Bley. Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, well, my pleasure.
I don't know that everybody knows who Carla Bley is and what her works represent on the American landscape. Could you talk about that a little bit?
That's strange because Carla, I think, was last in Cincinnati in 1971 when she was mixing the tracks of Escalator Over the Hill in what was our former studio in Clifton at Telford and Bryant Streets in the basement. Recording truck that was built for Butterfly Productions was assembled down there, but it was pulled up. It was an old bread truck. It was pulled up to the garage opening and the wires. The people sat inside the truck where the mixing board was and mixed the show while connected to 110 power inside the house. But I wasn't here for that, but rather Mike Mantler and Carla Bley came to Cincinnati to do the mixing in that truck because that truck had recorded the second half of the piece, of the records, in that truck at the Public Theater Building on Cooper Square in New York City. And that was the location of the Joseph Papp's Shakespeare in the Park location, and also Anthology Film Archives on the first floor, which is where I worked. And because of working there and being friends with the various people of the Shakespeare Festival, we were able to move our truck, which is rare. I mean, you couldn't leave it on the street on Lafayette Street. That wouldn't work. Or any street in Manhattan, we pulled it into a little side space outside the Anthology Film Archive windows. That enabled us to fork the wires up into the rehearsal hall where the last chunks of Escalator Over the Hill were recorded in the evenings. I could go there. I'd be done working at Anthology and go upstairs and shoot film.
Carl Bley's known, I think, primarily as a jazz composer and musician. Those words don't necessarily fit the definition of what Escalator Over the Hill really was.
Escalator Over the Hill was a groundbreaking album because it occurred at a time when 16-track recording was becoming normal, and that enabled you to do takes, continual takes, locked into what you'd recorded already. So that versatility allowed her to realize something that would otherwise have not been able to be done as it was done, which is mixing it up. And that really changed lots of sound that we're not really aware of because you don't know how what takes are down on a track and when they were recorded. And that's the main thing that she capitalized on. Yeah, she's a jazz musician, a piano player. Her name was Borg originally. She married Paul Bley, perhaps better-known jazz pianist. And after having been the hat check girl at Birdland, that for a nice white gospel-singing girl from Oakland was pretty remarkable. Carla's remarkable. I mean, she's really a star who wasn't ever recognized. And part of that is has to do with the fact that she's much better known in Europe than she is in the USA. And I don't know, she focused on Europe. I mean, they pay money to tour there. And that, for a jazz musician, is a paycheck. And that's where she's known, where her reputation has been built. But most of her stuff is rooted in America and in the sounds of big band music. That's unique, big band music.
Album when it was released, and I use the word album correctly, it was vinyl, three records, if I remember correctly, box set, came out on the Jazz Composers Orchestra Association, JCOA label. Do you know anything about the label itself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was JCOA we were doing this for, and the people involved in the record usually had some history with Carla. And that just meant JCOA was a bunch of musicians who were off the beaten path. But that's really what jazz music is. It's off the beaten path based on improvisation generally. In Carla's case, it was charted improvisation. And it held both complete scores for all the parts. But at the same time, her catchphrase was the fact that things were written in rubato. In other words, go off and do your thing as you do this idea. And that became, to me, the underpinning of this whole album that she'd done, was rubato. Do it your own way.
It sounds, when you listen to it, almost like an improvised opera.
Yeah, well, it was structured like an opera. I mean, there's singers that come in on cue that they have character names, and they sing parts that, unfortunately, having said that, if you listen to it, it really doesn't make a lot of sense because of the way the lyrics, if you will, the libretto was written by Paul Haynes. He was a collaborator with her and brought the words to the music mix. And that gives it tremendous amount of character in that they were often nonsensical couplings of words, but very beautiful because of his style. And what it resulted in was a piece of music that had a lot of texture and had a lot of sounds of other places. Was set in Rawalpindi, Pakistan, but India at that time, and or historically, and involved these unique voices in Jack Bruce, shortly before was in Cream, and then other people, an opera singer that Carla knew, a standard opera singer, garden variety, a soprano, and it also involved Linda Ronstadt, and Viva of Andy Warhol fame. I mean, a strange mix of people and jazz singers like Sheila Jordan from Cleveland. What a wonderful mix of these voices, along with some iconic jazz musicians like Don Cherry and other instrumentalists like John McLaughlin, Mahavishnu. What a strange and wonderful group of people to put together in the group. And I even ended up in Forest March singing on a chorus against my will, but what could you do? I was a filmmaker.
What inspired you to do the movie? What captivated you?
Well, what inspired me to do this thing was my mentor, Jonas Mekas, for whom I worked at Anthology Film Archives. He's still there today, all these years later. But in any event, Jonas sent me there. the same as Jonah's Head introduced me a few weeks later to John and Yoko. And he said these people, these musicians, want someone to shoot a film for them. And I thought you'd be the perfect guy. So I went to a rehearsal, met the group as they were rehearsing chorus parts up on 72nd Street at Timothy Marquand's penthouse apartment. And I just sort of went to this event and watched these people and thought, I can do this. Sounds familiar to me, the sounds I'm hearing. And it was. I mean, I'd grown up in Cincinnati, but I'd grown up surrounded or at least infused by jazz. It was nothing new to me, particularly when Rashawn Roland Kirk is the house band at Babe Baker's, which I can go to anytime I want to. That's what I meant, and that's really what made this very comfortable for me, and the fact that the musicians were outgoing, friendly people. Howard Johnson, tuba player, is from Massillon, Ohio. Big guy, football player, played in the band. But I just felt that these were people I knew already, and it was easy doing a film of people you know. I didn't know what I was doing, but I just began filming this thing, and by doing so, built session after session this small amount of footage relative to most documentary films of things like this, but still ample footage that enabled me to, because it was well shot, to put this thing together years later. There was an interval of many years from when I left New York City to living again in Cincinnati in the late 80s, where I didn't have the negative of the film, which meant I couldn't work on the film. So I found that Cincinnati prepared me by giving me certainly confidence to shoot films like this, and also the background in being a person who's listened to music of all sorts all of his life.
In looking at the film or watching the film, it occurred to me that it must have been a fairly arduous process to put the whole thing together. The editing seemed, there was a lot of editing. It seemed very personal, like there was a lot of work and thought that went into that process.
Well, there was, but it was simply that we had a thread, and I chose to approach the film by showing it in record format. In other words, from the beginning of album record number one through record number three, I followed that pathway that the music dictated rather than some other mode of assembling the footage. In other words, I kept it in chronological order and performance order. Once I'd made that decision, then I had to figure out, well, now what parts do I have? And what do I not have? Do I have all the meat? No, I didn't have Linda Ronstadt. That sort of limited my ability to use certain songs that I had other parts to, but I didn't have the key voice. For some reason, I seemed to have a thread. Not a literal thread, but there was no literal movie here, yeah, ever, no matter what I did. But I did have the ordering of the selections on the record as a key, and some areas were thicker than others, and it enabled me to approach them in a variety of ways, because some of the tunes weren't fully covered. In other words, we didn't have all the final overdub voices to all the parts, but I might have a filler part that was recorded early on by Carla, who often sang all the parts. If the actual singer hadn't shown up yet, she'd sing a scratch track that would later be sung, the proper part would be sung to. We had every sort of approach to what you got on the tail end, because some of the things were amazingly well covered, and had I been able to finish this film back in the 70s, I would have been hard-pressed to do it because the technology had not been developed yet to enable you to layer video like in the way 16 tracks were recorded at that time. You weren't able to deal with film in that same way because you didn't have a medium like digital video that would enable you to, or non-linear editing, that would enable you to put things on top of each other. It would be hit or miss. It would be done in a lab. You'd be making film copies. It would be very expensive or impossible to do. The enemy of all this is the budget. I mean, there is no budget. And what little bit of money I ever got in the way of a grant was at the very end of the thing, so that I was able in 1998 to make a proper transfer here in town at PPS. I was able to retransfer the negative, or the original, which was not negative. It was Ektachrome commercial, which was a reversal stock, an amazing color rendition of what I saw was available because I used that stock, but it was very, very slow. Thus, you needed a lot of light. Thus, it became complicated. Well, that enabled me, by the same process of reduction, to layer that film. It was not like layering negative film, which is dicey at best. This was really an ability to do a very creative approach to putting images together by being forced to wait until the late 90s to actually finish the film with high-resolution video enabling me. And that was where, for once, having to wait was better. Now, I don't recommend that. I mean, I hate waiting decades to finish a film. But in this case, that one thing made it better, and it's done.
Escalator Over the Hill, a music by Carla Bley, is a testament to a time in this country when people weren't afraid to experiment with music, and your film is a testament to that.
Is it even to you, the scheme should be told? Pleasing her so long in the courtyard, on the farm, in the hallway of her room, bloodying her vertebrae on the hardwood floor. 4 hours during her fate. Have ginger snug into a house. Have ginger toes to wait until a real house comes along. That buying the
David Delegator continues his conversation with Steve Gebhardt about his film 20 to Life, which focuses on Sinclair's poetry, social change, as well as jazz and blues music.
John Sinclair, a name out of the past in American life, the recent past. I'm not sure everybody knows who John Sinclair is and what he represents on the landscape of political freedom in this country.
Well, John is an outgrowth of the 60s in America. And somewhere along the line, there was a protest movement, whether it was at Kent State or draft cards being burned and student unions around the country. I was in college at that period of time. And John Sinclair, actually, I met in 1968 at the, I think it was a club called the Black Dome in Coryville. And he was with the MC5 in Cincinnati during the Spring Arts Festival of 1968 at the University of Cincinnati, which I was in charge of. I saw him as I saw a lot of different groups, artists, filmmakers, musicians, performance artists during that period, because we were doing this big deal Spring Arts Festival that essentially was a complete new thing at the university in the sense that it was so broad and came out of student development. And Sinclair was there at a club exploiting those moments with the MC5.
The wiggling is Oscar, the flash of the song. If you want to keep a rocket still, only come. Let me be who I am, and let me kick out the jam. Yeah, kick out the jam. I done kicked them out.
And then I find myself sometime later working for John Lennon and Yoko Ono in New York, and Jerry Rubin, who I'd gone to high school with and who was a roommate of mine in New York City at one point. Jerry had become friends with John and Yoko and announced to them that he was going to this rally for John Sinclair, who between the time I'd met him and then this point in 1971 was in prison for some marijuana beef he had. And back then, John Sinclair was the kind of guy, sort of like the honorary child. Tell him not to do something and he'll surely do it, and he'll do it worse than you were afraid of. He'll do it in such a way to make you so mad that you want to throw him in jail, and a lot of people did. And it had to do with marijuana and giving an undercover cop a couple of joints, which he was probably out to have. I mean, it was a woman. So they'd set him up with this undercover cop because they knew he'd give her drugs because he's trying to have sex with her. That's how John thinks. So that's what happened. And he finally had to go to prison for this because at that time, they'd throw you in prison for smoking joints, and that changed ultimately. But in the meanwhile, he had attracted the attention of Jerry Rubin, who was a member of the Chicago Seven. This was the revolution going on. Jerry was part of the counterculture. Their approach to civil disobedience was a little different, but not much. In other words, there was humor attached in it. But basically, John Sinclair was a pothead. I could identify with that, and I think that Sinclair would talk about the fact that he wasn't a member of the Scotch and Bourbon set, and that basically it was a conflict between marijuana and alcohol. And perhaps, you know, originally that's where the marijuana laws came from, in a trade-off for prohibition to the legalization of marijuana. That's it. That happened in the early 30s. We were aware of that. And as far as I was concerned, if Jerry Rubin was going off, he talked John and Yoko into going off to Ann Arbor to this rally for John Sinclair, who was at that time in Jackson Prison in Jackson, Michigan. I saw it as a film opportunity because that's what I did for John and Yoko. So I went there with my crew. Many people were from Ann Arbor, George Manupelli, Jay Cassidy, the people that worked on the film from there, worked on later films of mine, the Rolling Stones film, for instance, and this Hudson Tigers film that I did in 1975. I did a lot of work in Michigan. I went there to shoot with John and Yoko. We shot this evening festival all afternoon until late at night, and we shot it on film, and there were lots of luminaries there for the Chicago 7. Bobby Seale was there, gave an incredibly exciting speech from the point of view of the Black Panthers. There was a lot of stuff that was unusual. Reuben was there. He talked about the solidarity of saliva. Stevie Wonder was there with his band and show. And Bob Seger was there. Jazz artists were there. It was an amazing thing, which we filmed. And ultimately, the end of the whole evening was John Lennon and Yoko Ono appearing on stage with David Peel and the Lower East Side Band. Not much of a band, but that's what it was. And John was there playing acoustic guitar. We recorded it. That was the hook. That was the end of the film. We then cut on the thing for a year and a half to finish it. And then, after the film had played a week in London at a theater, and thus was out, and was shown in Ann Arbor. We were about to bring the film out. We had an offer for distribution. We're ready to go. Sinclair arrives in New York to talk to John and Yoko, and Yoko announced at that moment that she wanted to give all the money to women's causes. And of course, John Sinclair was more interested in that supporting his commune, perhaps the Rainbow People's Party headquarters on Hill Street in Ann Arbor, and was out of prison, you know, and had accomplished a rather major activity in getting the marijuana penalties in Michigan reduced to a $5 parking ticket fine. That was a big change from Sinclair going to jail for a couple of years as a result of a cop busting him. But there it was. So John Sinclair didn't like that idea, huffed and puffed, went with his group back to Ann Arbor, and that began a period of time which, in 1991, when from 1971, in 1991, I was working on my Bill Monroe film here, and at that time was conversing with Sinclair, and I said, well, John, you know, it's been 20 years since we did 10 for 2, so it seems obvious to me, an understatement, that that film wasn't going to come out. John Lennon had long been deceased. Yoko had no interest in putting the film out for whatever reason. And that was that. So I said, John, you've got a print of the film. You've shown this thing at various places. Let's just go on and do another film that we control that's not in the control of a woman who may not identify with your point of view. And we started 20 to Life, which for different reasons took years and years and years, 16 years, to finish. 16 years on top of 20 already. And that was a big price to pay, but until we came up with someone who donated completion money, we were stuck because there's no way you can make a film without having labs. Even a film glommed together from every possible source of media, whether that's 8mm film or whether it's VHS tapes or film, regular film, 16mm film. We glommed it together using anything we could in order to make this story that was not about getting out of prison on the part of John Sinclair. Wasn't a rally for his release, but it was a rally to release the idea. And that's what we tried to do. And that was why we set out in 1991 to make this film, which turned into 20 to Life.
John Sinclair was put away for 10 years for possessing 2 marijuana joints.
It ain't fair, John Sinclair, in the step of breathing air. Won't you care?
I was one of 56 people in my neighborhood around Wayne State University in Detroit who were swept up in what they called in the papers a lightning campus dope raid.
They sent an infiltrator into our group who just, you know, methodically set them up for a bust because they wanted to get them off the street and wanted to get them silenced.
56 arrested. Sinclair, the ringleader.
He spent 2 years of it in prison, virtually in isolation, in solitary.
It was such a serious ring that I was charged with giving 2 joints to an undercover police woman. Marijuana was improperly classified as a narcotic. It wasn't a narcotic in any way. It was a euphoriant.
After 2 years, it began to worry me, and he asked for some help. We went down, had a rally with 15,000 people. We went the only people.
Yeah!
Okay, crowd power didn't work, so we start again. Apathy doesn't count. Even singing is better than doing nothing.
This raid came down, and I was arrested and charged with what was at that time a felony narcotics charge, which carried upon conviction a minimum mandatory sentence of 20 years in prison with a maximum of life. So I was convicted, and that's when my nightmare just really started. I was sentenced to a 9.5 to 10 year sentence. That's a minimum of 9.5 years.
Got to set him free. Was he jailed for what he'd done or represented?
For 2.5 years, my family and my political associates, my friends, and thousands of people throughout this area carried on a campaign to try and gain my freedom.
Our friend Jerry Rubin had become close friends with John Lennon and Yoko Ono after they moved to New York City. And he told them about our case, and ultimately he said, well, I'm going out to Ann Arbor on December 10th to be in this thing for Sinclair. Why don't you guys come out too?
Oh, dear John Sinclair, we celebrate your liberty tonight.
The only answer is pressure.
If you want to change things, you have to take the shit in your hands and change it and tell the people that are doing the stuff you don't want them to do that you aren't going to let them do it anymore.
We came here not only to help John and to spotlight what's going on, but also to show and to say to all of you that apathy isn't it, and that we can do something. This song I wrote for John Sinclair. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Ten for Two still not out. It never will be. It's 40 years since Ten for Two was shot.
Who has the rights to that?
Yoko owns her footage. She owns the negative. She paid for the negative. She owns the negative. But I don't think she's ever cleared the performances. And lots of the people who were in the performances are dead, including Jerry Rubin, and two of the MC5 are dead. Sinclair's alive, but then his brother is dead, who's in the film. And so on. It goes on that way because time has a way of erasing the cast of characters.
Well, 20 to Life shows Sinclair for a lot more than being a pothead. I mean, he was a figure that people seem to be drawn to as part of a counterculture in Detroit, you know, which is a fairly reactionary place.
That's true. But the question is, and it's not up to me to judge that, he's a hero and manages to live his life pretty much with no fixed address. And that takes a lot more nerve. I mean, I can't do that, unfortunately. He gave all of his archives to the Bentley Library at the University of Michigan. So his legacy is sitting in a library. But when you make films, unfortunately, somebody's got to tend to that, or it gets thrown in the garbage bin. And in the case of John Sinclair, he's able to live 6 months out of the year in Europe, based, I guess, on a three-month visa allotment, and seems to do 3 months here, 3 months there, more or less back and forth over year after year. I don't feature living in that sort of impermanent situation. But it suits his ideas because he doesn't have to pay apartment rent as he once did, whether he's there or not. And he pretty much lives his transient, itinerant bard life and gets away with it.
You know it's true. Ashes to ashes, dirt to dirt. Love, work, and suffer is our sentence here on Earth. And ain't nobody getting out of here alive. So, whatsoever you may do, or howsoever great thou art, when it all ends up, baby, it's just like little Milton say, you got to go back to Mother Earth.
For a long time, he set foot in New Orleans and made a name for himself culturally in New Orleans.
Well, yes, and we filmed his show at WWOZ. And that's the one thing about John. He's dedicated himself to this music that he is an authority on and has archived pretty much of his favorites and bring them to people in the form of radio shows, which he does today on Radio Free Amsterdam, I suppose, and some other way that he walks around with an MP3 recorder and puts his shows together wherever he is. Well, I was in Italy with him 4 years ago when we released this film in an infamous Italian tour before our infamous Michigan tour. We were at a festival in Pitigliano, Italy, which is in the southwestern corner of Tuscany, as far away from Florence as you can get without going to another country. But in any event, we were there, and he pulls out his recorder and starts recording his radio show when we're at a bed and breakfast. And he's got the music right there on some sort of other device and puts it all together and makes these shows. And it's what he does.
Caught between drums, one set to the side as one is above, blowing as the other measured rolls. Above me, the horn is played for the ear where I live here with a drum aside either side of my head as the music defines this our home here where we play this day by day. The horns drum the music in my head as the broken pulse, smooth pulse, the music moves through my head as the words sing themselves to the page as music. Thank you.
Now, I don't know how he makes money out of it, because he does try to make money out of everything he does somehow. But somehow he ekes by, and those things are able to be heard. Well, the same is true. He's got archives of all of his shows on WWOZ, all of his shows on WDET in Detroit, public radio station there. And that's as good a job as I can think of for John Sinclair, because he doesn't like to get up in the morning, and he doesn't like to do anything that resembles work, physical work, and doesn't have any of those traits, but certainly can put these radio shows together if you like his music. I like his music, but I find it very limited because it's pretty much stuck to the African-American experience.
That's a long way from the MC5, who is pretty much the first punk band on the planet.
I think John did it for the social benefits that he got out of that.
He was more a manager of the band, right?
Well, if you can call it, I mean, I wonder what that management was like. What he did do was make cassettes of all the performances they did, and all those cassettes now, not reel-to-reel tapes, occasionally that, but those cassettes became the basis of a series of recordings that John released years later. Shining things, he's able to turn things into pearls, but they're really just pigskin.
I wonder if there are any MC5A tracks out there in flea markets somewhere.
I think that John cornered the market. I mean, yes, like the Grateful Dead, that stuff just ends up, everybody's got a recording going. I was at the Preservation Hall Del McCoury band performance, and there's always somebody in there, regardless of the fact that you're not allowed to bring in flash bulbs and certainly not allowed to use recording devices. There's always some guy that's bootlegging something, sticking a mic up because he's got it down his sleeves, and people are willing to steal anything. Well, that's that same philosophy is what kept Sinclair's legacy going, because people did record all these things, and somehow they're with us today.
Well, it's a very interesting documentary, 20 to Life, the Life and Times of John Sinclair, American pothead, political prisoner, disc jockey, performance artist, poet, musician. Steve Gebhardt, the filmmaker, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Lucky one, or the one with your number written all over it. 123507 in the poet's case, walking out the front door of the penitentiary, 8:30 p.m., 14 years ago today. 2 times 7 years, the cycle of struggle to make it through in one piece. On the yard or in these streets, anyone who can pick up a frying pan owns death, Burroughs said. And sometime in New York City, coming back from the recording studio, walking up to his front door,
John Lennon with a gun stuck in his face. Oh, oh, sweet giant of song with heart of huge dimension and eyes deep in the sky. There has to be a day when each of us must pass beyond this tedious sphere to enter some wondrous place of which we do not know whether we're ready or not. Some other place or space out of time where no punk with a weapon will ever press you again or blow off your face out of the depths of his madness. No one will hold us against our will in a cell with bars in front and back, 8 feet by 6 feet by 10 feet high. No one will take us out of our natural lives and send us away from here by means of some murderous fantasy in which we are denied everything we have lived for. Oh, please let us die at the end of our own time and not before, free in our world of strife. Let us have life as long as we can, and please let there be men like Monk and John Lennon to share of their hearts and light up our ways as long as we may live.
You've been listening to Steve Gebhardt, Cincinnati filmmaker. A special about two of Mr. Gebhardt's films, Carla Bley's jazz opera Escalator Over the Hill and 22 Life, The Life and Times of John Sinclair. The interview was conducted by David Delegater. Technical support from Ron Esposito and Kevin Rowinski. You can find links to Steve Gebhardt's films at WVXU.org. I'm producer and host, Lee Hay. Thank you.